If you were a Braves fan in the 80s or 90s, and it was 7:05 or 7:35, say on a Tuesday night, you were probably carrying your TV tray into the living room to sit on the couch, or as my grandparents called it, the Davenport, to watch the Atlanta Braves on TBS. And if you flipped on the TV and you heard this, you knew it was going to be a good night.
Hello again, everybody. Don Sutton along with Skip Carey. Welcome to Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. The first of three, the Braves and the Giants. And making his ninth start, left-hander Tom Glavine.
Glavine into the wind, and the lefty delivers, and it's low and outside, and we're underway from Atlanta.
Atlanta Braves Hall of Fame pitcher Tom Glavine is my guest today on the Lost Ballparks podcast.
This is Harry Carey with Jack Buck and Jerry Gross from the beautiful new Bush Memorial Stadium. And boy, I tell you, this is some sight.
The crowd still is coming in. The bleacher area in center field almost filled. And the indication is that it's going to be a fine Friday night crowd here at the Polo Grounds.
We're underway in the first of a twi-night doubleheader at Tiger Stadium.
Greetings, baseball fans. This is Mel Allen greeting you from Yankee Stadium in New York City.
The F&M Schaefer Brewing Company, very happy to be pouring it to you from Ebbets Field tonight. And there should be a humdinger.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Al Helfer with Art Gleason bringing you Mutual's Game of the Day from Sunny Shy Park in the city of Philadelphia.
Just the start of things. So pull up a comfortable chair. If you want to take your shoes off, go ahead. Wiggle your toes, and we hope you'll have a cold shave or two throughout the evening.
Tom Glavine was a 10-time All-Star, World Champion, World Series MVP, 2-time Cy Young Award winner, 4-time Silver Slugger, and finished his career with 305 wins and was a first ballot Hall of Famer. Tom Glavine, welcome to the Lost Ballparks podcast. How are you?
I'm good. Sorry about the delay. I couldn't get my stupid ear pods connected, so I had to find another set of headphones.
No worries. You grew up in Billerica, Massachusetts. By the way, am I saying that right? Am I even close? Is that how you say it?
Yes, Billerica. Well, yeah, if you want to say it right, it's Billerica.
Billerica, okay.
Yeah, there you go.
About 20 miles northwest of Boston, so I'm guessing that the first major league game that you ever attended was at Fenway. Is that true? And if so, what do you remember about that day?
I just remember being in the right field bleachers. I think it was my first game that I went to, but I remember Dwight Evans being out in right field. You know, I used to watch him, and a guy was on third base, how he got himself into position to catch the fly ball and be in a position to make a throw to the plate. And I just remember going to the game that day and watching him practice in the outfield and then take infield and just being in awe of his arm. Just like, wow, you know, and watching it on TV didn't do it justice. So it was probably that. And then funny, when I ended up playing ball professionally, it seemed like every year I played, all everybody talked about was how do we speed up the games. And as a kid, I just remember I never wanted the game to end. I was hoping for extra innings. I mean, I would have been perfectly fine being there all night. So it was kind of an ironic change.
My first game was in Cleveland, and it was, I think, a 17 or 18 inning game, and I loved it. I was like,
oh, yeah, it's perfect, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, let's play 25. Who cares?
Yeah. Who cares? Yeah, let's just keep going. Yeah.
You were 9 years old when the Red Sox faced the Cincinnati Reds in the 75 World Series.
It's going to be Boston and Cincinnati for the World Championship starting Saturday in Boston. Little Fenway Park. Will Johnny Bench, Tony Perez, and George Foster be able to hit that fence? Louis Tion, 35, going on 45 with all his wiggles and jiggles. Joe Morgan on the baseline. Carl Yastrzemski is making a dramatic personal comeback. Oh, there's going to be all kinds of stories.
Do you remember watching that series?
I do. I remember a lot of it. I don't think I was awake for the Carlton Fisk home run. Obviously, saw the highlights. I remember Bernie Carbo and his epic pinch hit home runs in that series.
There he is, Bernie Carbo. Two base hits, two home runs.
So, I mean, I remember a lot of the bits and pieces. I obviously remember the outcome, and I remember it being just a great series in terms of the play and the action and how close it was. Certainly disappointed my boys didn't win, but I guess I was smart enough even at that age to realize what a fantastic series it was. And to this day, it goes down as one of the greatest of all time.
Were you one of those kids who would wake up in the morning and pull out the sports page and take a look at the box score every day?
Oh, absolutely. When I got up in the morning, if I was not able to stay awake long enough to see the outcome of the game and I knew it was close, if my dad wasn't there in the morning, then absolutely. I was trying to find a box score to find out who won the game.
I'm sure as a kid growing up in Massachusetts, too, you probably spent many days in the backyard pretending you were Yaz or Jim Rice or Fred Lynn.
I did. You know, it's funny. I think the position players were more the guys that I liked, right? I mean, obviously, everybody loved Yaz. But I think more so for me in the height of my childhood, so to speak, and my beginning to love baseball was kind of the Fred Lynn and Jim Rice era. I probably liked Fred Lynn a tiny bit more just because he played center field and made more of the spectacular plays.
Fly ball hit well to center field. Lynn racing back. He will make the catch. What a catch by Freddie Lynn. Geronimo three quarters of the way down to third. And Fred Lynn has just turned in the defensive play of the game.
I think if I was in the backyard playing wiffle ball and I needed to hit a home run, I was Jim Rice.
And he probably hammers it to left. Reigns goes back. It's gone. Home run on the road for Jim Rice.
You know, those guys were fun to watch. It's funny, though. They never really had a pitcher during my childhood. Obviously, they had Bill Lee, and I don't want to say that my style as a kid was similar to his, but I think him and maybe Roger Maret were the two lefties that I remember as a kid, but neither one of those guys were guys that I tried to emulate or anything like that. But back then, I was still playing center field at first base and hitting and doing all those things, so I probably tried to emulate Freddie Lynn and Jim Rice more than I did any of the pitchers.
In 1984, you were drafted by the Atlanta Braves in the second round, but in addition to baseball, you were an outstanding hockey player in high school. I think you scored 6 goals, or at least on more than one occasion. And so 5 days after the Major League Baseball draft, you were selected by the LA Kings. You could have played with Wayne Gretzky.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You know, I was obviously in the big leagues when that trade happened, and remember people, reporters coming up to me when he got traded and asking me what I thought. And people who don't know me, I can be very sarcastic at times. When a reporter started asking me, I don't know why, but my response right away was, well, it's a good thing for Wayne I didn't play, because he would have had to move to left wing. I was the center. So, you know, and you know, people just kind of looked at me like, what? You know, but one of those things that, look, I was a better hockey player coming out of high school than I was a baseball player. And I say that just from the standpoint of I was much more polished as a hockey player. As a baseball player, particularly as a pitcher, I had a good arm. I didn't know what I was doing. My mechanics were terrible, but I had a good arm. And that's what I got drafted on. And I think, you know, I guess the epitome of what you hear so often from scouts as a baseball player. Well, if he's got a good arm, we can teach him how to pitch. And I think that was certainly the case. A hockey player, I was an all-around good player. Like I said, I was much more polished. But at that stage of the game for me, I mean, look, I say it all the time when I give speeches or I talk to people. It's like you talk about a 5 to 10 day span as an 18-year-old where I really dug myself.
Yeah.
I mean, I had it going on, right? I mean,
yeah,
getting drafted
seriously.
By 2 sports. So yeah, I mean, it was a cool period, obviously, but it didn't come without stress. I mean, it was not an easy decision, so to speak. I mean, my dad was a construction worker, had his own small business. So for me to have a college scholarship, that was a big deal. And I think that was the decision more than, am I going to go sign with the Braves or am I going to go sign with the LA Kings? You know, in hockey, the situations are different. In hockey, you get drafted and they hold your rights for 5 years. Baseball, it's when the next school year starts, if you haven't signed, then they lose you. So much more urgency to sign in baseball than hockey. And the Kings drafted me. I got the phone call that, hey, drafted you. We know you're going to UMass Lowell to play hockey and we'll keep an eye on you. We'll talk to you after your junior year. And that was kind of it.
Yeah.
But for me, it was more, do I want to sign and take a chance with baseball, or do I want to utilize this college scholarship? Because like I said, I did not take that lightly.
By 1987, you're pitching in AAA for the Richmond Braves, and you have the opportunity to play at a great old historic ballpark, McCoy Stadium, home of the Pawtucket Red Sox. For decades, because of how the dugouts at McCoy were built, embedded underneath the grandstands, fans in the front row, some 7 or 8 feet above, would dangle a rope attached to a milk jug or a bucket or a fishing reel with a pen and a baseball card hooked on the end of a line. And once a player in the dugout had signed it, he would tug the rope or fishing line and the fan would reel it back in. I'm just curious, did they have that when you were visiting? I wonder if they would do that to opposing teams, or maybe that was just for the home team.
No, they did. I mean, that was a big deal for me to play there. I mean, like I said, obviously growing up a big Red Sox fan, that was really the closest that I got in my professional career to playing in my hometown. So it was an easy drive for everybody to come down to Pawtucket when I played there. So, you know, it was a great opportunity to see my family and you know, play in front of family and friends really for the first time. And so that was a big deal. And, you know, at that time, still being in the minor leagues and trying to make my way, I still was somewhat of a Red Sox fan. So I was aware of a lot of their guys in the minor leagues. And so that was an interesting dynamic. But yeah, you know, I think that was my first introduction to that maneuver, so to speak, for getting autographs. And you know, it's kind of like, what is going on? Yeah. You know, and then you realize what people are trying to do. And, you know, it's kind of cool, creative way for people to not necessarily have that access along a foul line wall or something like that, to where they got creative.
August 17th, 1987, you get called up to the big leagues and your debut was at Houston's Astrodome. You walk into that place, Tom, and you think...
A couple of things. Number one, kind of like that, what am I doing here? How did I get here? Dream come true kind of thing. And then you go out onto the field and you see the Astrodome and it's like, what is this? I had never seen anything like that, obviously. At that time, I think it was still dubbed the eighth wonder of the world. It was just a crazy place. And it didn't take me long to realize how special a place it was for the home team. The Astros were in the hunt for the playoffs that year. And that place was loud. And I'd never experienced anything like that in terms of a stadium being loud like that. So there were, on top of making my debut and kind of trying to get my feet wet and come to grips with all that, there was the added bonus of trying to deal with a stadium that I had never seen before and you know, a noise level that I had never experienced before. So there was a lot going on.
5 days later, you get your first home start and your first major league win at Fulton County Stadium back in Atlanta. After the game, Braves hitting coach, Pirates legend Willie Stargell, who would be inducted into the Hall of Fame the following year, comes up to you and he does what?
He handed me a game ball and had inscribed on it that it was my first major league win, with a rather big expletive on there, beginning with the F, with the letter F. So it was my first effing win. And I remember looking at it and thinking, I can't put this somewhere. I can't let my mom see this. Like, I can't believe he did that. Like, I was kind of, you ruined it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then he gave me the real one. So it was, it was pretty good. He got me for sure. Absolutely.
A lot is said about Fulton County Stadium, you know, being a multi-purpose cookie cutter like the others from that era. But I'm sure that there were one or two things that made it stand out or unique to you.
Well, you know, it was the ballpark of that era. You know, when you looked around baseball at that time, we had Fulton County and we shared it with the Falcons. You had Three Rivers that was the Pirates and the Steelers. You had Philadelphia that was the Phillies and the Eagles. And I'm sure there were more. Cincinnati had the same stadium. I'm not sure if they shared it with the Bengals. I think they did. So
they did, yeah.
So it was kind of that multi-purpose stadium, AstroTurf, although in Atlanta we had grass, so that one was different. But even though they were all kind of cookie cutters, they all had their little idiosyncrasies to them. And I think in Atlanta, for years, it was called the launching pad. Up until Colorado, it was the highest elevation in baseball. And in the summertime, the ball flew out of that ballpark.
Deep to left field, this should be the ball game. Dale Murphy wins it for Atlanta.
And so that was kind of one of the things that we knew, obviously, and one of the things that once myself and Smoltzy and Avery and all those guys started to get to the big leagues, that was kind of one of our unwritten things that we wanted to do, was kind of dispel that notion that it was a launching pad and turn it more into a pitcher's ballpark. And we did. We turned that around a little bit, but it was still, you know, in the summertime, it was a hitter's ballpark. Funny, again, in those stadiums, they all had tunnels down the left field line and the right field line. And when the wind would get blowing, the wind would kind of go through the whole stadium in a funnel almost. And that the way it would circulate down those lines is like you would almost have a jet stream going down the line, down into those tunnels. So you could feel it. And not that you could control it, but you did your best to try to keep a ball from going down those lines in the summertime because that wind was sucking it right out of the ballpark.
You mentioned in your book, Inside Pitch, Playing and Broadcasting the Game I Love, that there were ballparks that you felt more comfortable in than others. What were a couple that you thought, okay, I feel good pitching here?
Well, probably the top of the list would be the old Riverfront Stadium in Cincinnati.
It's time for Braves baseball. Good afternoon, everyone. Along with John Sterling, this is Ernie Johnson speaking to you from Riverfront Stadium in Cincinnati.
I don't know what it was or why it was, but that was about as close as I got to being able to just throw my glove on the field and I was going to win. I don't know why that ballpark was so good to me and I pitched so well there, but I think I was like 16-5 in my career in that ballpark, something kind of crazy. I was not uncomfortable out there. I wouldn't say that it wasn't a kind of a ballpark where I took the mound and it was like, this is awesome. I love pitching here, but there was nothing about it that was uncomfortable. And I think in my mind, I knew that I had good success fit there. And of course, confidence breeds a lot of things. So knowing I had success there, I think played a big part in me continuing to pitch well there. Wrigley Field was kind of hit or miss. If you went into Wrigley, the first thing you did when you got off the bus was to look up at the flags and see which way the flags were blowing.
Beautiful day for baseball. The wind blowing in from right field. It will not help the left-handed hitters. They'll have a little difficulty getting out. It is a kind of a gentle breeze, though, about 8-10 miles an hour coming off of Lake Michigan.
And if they were blowing in, it was like, okay, this is going to be a great day. If they were blowing out, you're doing everything you can to keep the ball on the ground. And for me, as a ground ball pitcher, that played into my game plan anyway. And I think the thing I loved about Wrigley Field was their infield grass was so thick. I mean, you had to shoot a ball through a cannon to get a ground ball through that infield. So that always played into my favor. San Diego, I always loved pitching out there because the ball didn't travel real well. Same for L.A. Now, probably the one ballpark that I hated. And again, I don't know why I wasn't like I went out there and I was uncomfortable was the old Joe Robbie Stadium in Miami. I will be honest, I hated their bullpen because I always felt like the bullpen was not lined up properly. And I always felt like I was throwing at a crooked angle to the point where I never said anything. But I know my pitching coach, Leo Mazzoni, at one point in time had the grounds crew come out and measure it and make sure that it was right. And it was, and I knew it was, but it just felt wrong to me every time I threw in that bullpen. And subsequently, I'd carry that with me out onto the mound, not feeling comfortable. And then knowing that I didn't have much success there, conversely, like I had in Cincinnati, where I knew I did, all those things play on your mind a little bit. But there weren't too many ballparks that I just hated to pitch in. I remember my first few times pitching in LA before they did some renovations. It was weird because you would throw in the bullpen there and the bullpen was really confined and small. And because it was confined, you'd be popping the catcher's mitt, which for me was like, oh man, I'm throwing hard today.
Yeah.
You know, and then you get out on that mound. And because initially the stands behind home plate were so far behind the plate, it almost felt like you were pitching from second base. And it felt so far away. And then all of a sudden you go out there after your bullpen where you're popping the mitt and it's like, you can hardly hear anything. You're thinking to yourself, you know, what happened?
What happened to my stuff?
Yeah, exactly. So when they made the renovations and they moved the fence behind home plate closer to home plate, then it became a little bit better. But initially I remember thinking, man, I just feel like I'm pitching from second base out here. And it was funny because I think initially early in my career, I had really good success out there, but Shea Stadium, when I went and pitched there, I didn't realize it initially when I came in as a visitor, but man, in April and May, when it was cold, what a great place to pitch. I mean, you had to absolutely hit a cannon to get a ball out of that ballpark. So it was a great pitcher's ballpark early in the year. When it heated up, summertime, the ball flew a little bit more. So those are some of the nuances of some of the ballparks you play in.
From 87 to 91, the Braves were 251 and 392. And you say it was so bad that it was hard for you or other players to get tee times at local country clubs. Is that true?
Maybe. I mean, put it this way. It wasn't like anybody was going out of their way to get us tee times. You
right.
know, I mean, it wasn't like you'd say, hey, you know, this is Tom Glavine from the Braves. Can I come play golf? And they wouldn't care.
They weren't rolling out the red carpet for you.
No, they weren't rolling out the red carpet. So that obviously changed over time.
There was a switch that flipped in 1991. When you came to spring training, you had a sign above your locker that said, it's payback time. You start the season with a 12-4 record, a 1.98 ERA. You're selected to start for the National League in the All-Star game at Toronto Sky Dome.
You'll notice Tommy Glavine can't work quickly enough. He wants the ball back, and he wants to come back at him again.
That was the 50th anniversary of Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak and Ted Williams hitting .406. Both were there that night, honored on the field before the game. Did you get to meet them, or did you see that, or were you too busy warming up and kind of focusing on what you had to do?
Yeah, I was too busy warming up. I remember them being there, and I remember what a big deal it was that they were there. And I think for me at that stage of my career, I don't want to say I was 100% going through it, but for those first 2 years in the big leagues, there are multiple times where you're taking the mound and you're facing somebody for the first time. Remember that first half, not even half season, but when I got called up in 1987 in August, I remember my first few starts taking the mound and thinking, this is Daryl Strawberry. This is Mike Schmidt. Facing these guys that I'd grown up watching, watched on TV, and now here I am competing against them. So I think it took a while to get kind of past all that and realize that A, they're no different than me, and B, I'm competing with them now at this level. I can do this. So, but still, there would be opportunities like that where you would see a Hall of Famer or a guy that was really from before my time that you knew an awful lot about but never got to see play, kind of the legends of the game, that when they were around, it was a big deal. But unfortunately, yeah, and that opportunity, I was getting ready for the game, so I didn't get a chance to meet those guys. But I think anytime you're around those guys, you appreciate their greatness and appreciate what they did for the game, for sure.
That year, in a game against the Cardinals at Busch Stadium, you say that you played in a game with the hottest conditions of your career. And this blows my mind. I don't know how you pitch in 114-degree weather, 114 degrees down on the turf.
Funny, I remember that game, but I remember one, I think, after that in Philadelphia that was even hotter. Now, what was different about St. Louis, I don't know what was different with the turf in St. Louis, but this is the first time I'd ever seen this, too, where when you're playing on that turf, guys generally will wear plastic spikes instead of wearing the metal spikes, particularly the infielders. And I remember the infielders coming in between innings. I remember seeing the trainers have all these, like these cardboard boxes that you would have like a case of beer or a case of soda that would come in. And all these cardboard boxes were laid out on the ground in the dugout and they were full of ice. And I was like, you know, what the hell's going on? And these guys would come in off the infield and they would put their cleats in the ice because the heat on the turf, the plastic cleats were melting.
Oh my gosh.
So, you know, they were doing that. And then they had, you know, guys would have cabbage leaves in their hats to try to keep them cool. I mean, it was stuff that, again, coming from Massachusetts, I'd never seen that before. Well, I didn't know what the hell was going on.
You changed your uniform, I think, a couple times.
Oh yeah, you have to. I mean, I was, hate to say, superstitious. I like to call it more routine oriented, but
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I never would do that. And you go to a ballpark like that and pitch in those kind of conditions. Yeah. You're changing your uniform top at least every other inning because you're soaking wet.
And you weighed yourself after the game. Do you remember how much weight you lost?
I lost like 10 pounds.
Yeah.
It was something, it was crazy. Look back at it and you're like, how the heck you do that? But just part of it, you know, you learn to deal with it. And again, it's one of those things I guess you appreciate to some extent, but you think, man, this is miserable. But then you think back to the era before us where guys were doing that and they were wearing wool uniforms. So
right.
We had it maybe not as bad as they did.
I grew up in Ohio, and in addition to being an Indians fan, I was also a Braves fan because of TBS. I mean, I probably, Tom, was able to watch more Braves games than Indians games. There wasn't much to cheer about in the 80s for either team, except for maybe Dale Murphy.
Right.
But by the early to mid-90s, that fantastic TBS broadcast crew, which is one of my favorites, had a lot to be excited about.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Atlanta, where tonight it's game three in the series between the Houston Astros and the Atlanta Braves. I'm Pete Van Wehren, along with Skip Carey, welcoming you to Atlanta Fulton County Stadium.
This team was starting to come together.
Driven high and deep to right field. Mondesi back, and this ball is out of here. The Braves win.
Funny, because I hear that same thing from a lot of people. When they grew up as kids and they were baseball fans, they were either Braves fans or Cubs fans because of WGN and WTBS. And give Ted Turner credit, he had a vision. I think maybe as bad as the Braves were, people thought he was crazy putting baseball on TBS, but sure worked out well. But we did become the America's team, so to speak, of baseball in that era because of that. And it was really crazy where we would go into visiting ballparks and the amount of fan base we would have in visiting ballparks. And I remember when I first got to the big leagues and we weren't very good, when we would play the Cubs or we would play the Cardinals at home or even the Mets in Atlanta, it was almost like a home game for those teams because they had so many people there. And that kind of became the case for us in 91 and beyond, where every time we went on the road, our fan base was just huge. And it was for that reason. Going into one of these cities where they obviously have a local team to watch, you're getting people that move there from Atlanta, say, that are, or from the Southeast that are still Braves fans and are able to watch on TBS all the time, or that home team's not playing real well. So people can watch us on TV every night. So they know us, they get to like us. And now they become a little bit more of a fan in any given year because, you know, their home team's not doing so well. So it was a really cool dynamic to see how the fan base grew like that. And I had the same thing back home. I remember when I first got to the big leagues, my hometown did not have WTBS on their cable TV package. I think they had the Met station, WOR or WWOR, whatever it was. And I remember my parents or somebody started a petition with the cable company and got enough signatures that following year they added TBS to their package. So everybody back home got to watch me every night too, which was cool.
We should talk for a second about that Braves pitching staff featuring Greg Maddux, you, John Smoltz, Steve Avery, this staff, and I think maybe you could make a case for the 71 Orioles staff with Palmer, Cuellar, McNally, and Dobson, are the two greatest pitching staffs in baseball, or were the two greatest pitching staffs in baseball history.
I like being in the conversation. I know that when people talk about some of the greatest staffs in the history of the game, yeah, that Baltimore staff comes up a lot. I think that was one year, I want to say 98 maybe, with us, that I think me, Smoltzy, maybe not Smoltzy because he might have been hurt, but there were four of us. And I know it was me, Smoltzy, Maddux, Denny Nagel, Kevin Millwood, but four out of the five of us had won 15 games or more. And I think it was the first time since one of the staffs of the Washington Senators had done it. Those are the groups that we get talked about. But I would say particularly it's our group and the Orioles group with Palmer and Cuellar and those guys. And look, I don't know. I mean, it's so hard to compare to me. It's so hard to compare eras. The game's different. I mean, the game's so different even now for me from when I retired, which was only 12 years ago, 14 years ago. So the game changes a lot in a short period of time. And I just like the fact that we did enough as a group that we're in the conversation.
The Braves went to the World Series in 91, 92, but 95, that team that season, it all came together with 90 wins. The Braves take the NL East and then go on a tear in the playoffs, winning 7 out of 8 playoff games against the Rockies and the Reds, including a sweep of the Reds in the NLCS to advance to the 1995 World Series. The Braves lead the series 3-2, with the sixth game being played at Fulton County. Before Game 6, you drove to the ballpark like you always did with Greg Maddux, which I found fascinating. What did he say to you that trip to the ballpark that day?
It's funny when you talk about that and we won 7 out of 8 and went into the World Series. It sounds a lot easier now than it was. Those were tough series. You know, I remember, I think that was the second or third year of the wild card. And for us, we win our division. Our reward is we get to go on the road to start the wild card series in Colorado. That's not an easy place to go. And when they had the Blake Street Bombers back then, so you're trying to navigate through Castilla, Galarraga, Larry Walker. I mean, these Dante Bichette, I mean, that was a good ball club. So
that was.
It wasn't like we were going in there thinking, hey, we're playing the Rockies. This is going to be a breeze. It was a tough series. And we had to come back. If my memory serves me well, we had to come back in Colorado and win at least one game. It was a tough opening round, played really well against Cincinnati, the divisional championship, and didn't do much of anything wrong in that series. But to your point, we go into Cleveland and play that team. And look, that was best offensive club I ever pitched against. Top to bottom, those guys were really, really good. And, you know, truth be told, we had a chance to win that thing in Game 5 in Cleveland. And when we didn't, I was pissed.
Oral Hershiser, Jim Thome, Albert Bell, and all the rest going back to Atlanta for a Game 6.
That's one of the odd dynamics in the playoffs is when you're the next guy up in terms of being the starting pitcher and there's a chance you don't have to pitch because your team has won and you can move on or you can win the series, you don't want to have to pitch. Your mindset is you've prepared for that game, but you hope it doesn't happen. In this case, obviously, we win Game 5, series over, we're World Series champions. I don't want a Game 6. So when we got beat in Game 5, yeah, I was pissed because we didn't win the World Series. And it really wasn't until we landed in Atlanta early that morning that I started to embrace the fact that, okay, I've got an opportunity here to do something. And I remember we had an off day, so we had a workout, and I was driving the ballpark with Greg, and I asked him, I said, hey, he didn't pitch poorly in Game 5, but he didn't dominate the way he did in Game 1. So I said to him, I said, hey, did they make adjustments to you or what do you think? He said to me, he said, listen, I didn't pitch well. He said, just go out there and do what you do and you're going to be fine. And to me, that was a big deal because I think the mistake that so many guys make, I wasn't immune to it myself, but I think the mistake so many guys make when you are in a series like that or you make back-to-back starts against a team is you feel like you have to make adjustments.
Joe Morgan, Bob Uecker, Bob Costas up in the booth. A lot is made about a team doing better the second time around against a pitcher.
And I always kind of fought that a little bit because I thought, well, if I pitched well and I did my thing, then why do I need to make adjustments? Why can't I just go out there and do what I did and make them make adjustments?
Certainly the Indians adjusted to Greg Maddux, beat him in game five, but hitters aren't the only ones who can adjust.
And then you sometimes make adjustments that you didn't need to make. So to hear him say that, I think just reaffirmed to me that don't make any changes just because you think you have to.
Well, you always expect a good hitting team to do better the second time around against a good pitcher. But so much has been made about the Indians moving closer to the plate and taking the outside corner away from Greg Maddux. Since they had some success doing that, you can expect them to do the same tonight against Tom Glavine. But Glavine will combat this by coming inside a little more often and keeping them honest.
You get to Fulton County Stadium that night, and you've got a decision to make. It seems insignificant, perhaps, to others, but I love how when you get there, you're thinking, okay, should I wear one undershirt or two?
You know, I mean, again, it's that superstition thing, right? I mean, it was cold, late October, it's chilly, so I don't remember what I did. I don't remember what I decided.
I think you picked two, okay. Including your lucky blue Notre Dame football t-shirt.
Oh, yeah, I always had that on. That was always on somewhere, for sure, yeah.
You didn't have a lot of superstitions, but you did have one with the bazooka gum, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I always had I always chewed gum when I pitched, and I always had one in my back pocket as a spare. I don't know why, because it never came out, right? If I got another piece of gum, I never used that one that was in my pocket. So I'm not really sure how and why that started, but kind of thing that once you start having some success and things are going good, you don't change anything. So that was part of the equation for me, yeah.
You threw a gem that night, giving up one hit, no runs, eight strikeouts. Mark Wohlers comes in and closes out the ninth.
51,000 plus on their feet. Nobody's left to beat the traffic tonight, I guarantee you. Mark gets the sign. The wind and the pitch. Here it is. Swung. Fly ball deep left center. Grissom on the run. Yes! The Atlanta Braves have given you a championship. Listen to this crowd.
The Braves win the series. You win the World Series MVP.
This was a battle. This was no easy thing. The Indians played great, and we knew coming in here it was going to be a tough series. But everybody in here did what we needed them to do. And if I could cut this thing up into 25 pieces, everybody in here deserves it, because it took a total team effort for us to win this thing.
And for a kid growing up in Massachusetts, pretending maybe that he was Louis Tiant pitching his team to a world championship, your dream comes true.
It was crazy. I mean, when everybody always asked me, you know, what's the best game you ever pitched? Well, obviously, it's easy to pick that one. There are a couple others that I think in terms of technicalities that I went out and executed a game plan about as good as I could, or as good as I did that night. It just wasn't on that stage, obviously. So to be able to go out and do that and under those circumstances obviously makes it the best game that I ever pitched. But people talk about being in the zone and all that stuff. I mean, I guess that's what it was. Had a really good bullpen session that night before the game. But to be honest, I didn't pay a ton of attention to those, because I can't tell you how many times I would throw a bullpen and think, man, I got great stuff today, and I'd go out and get killed. And there were other times where I'd come out of the bullpen thinking, what am I going to do today? And I'd throw a shutout. So I didn't put a ton of emphasis on it other than how I felt. And as long as I felt good, then I thought I'd figure some things out. But that night when I came out of that bullpen, I knew I had a good bullpen, and I knew I had good stuff. And it was just a matter of when I walked out there, did I bring it with me? And I did. That first inning, I got through it in a breeze, and I thought, all right, man, what I had in the bullpen, I just brought with me here tonight. Let's go. Now, I didn't envision doing what I did, like I said, because that was a good lineup. And to think that you're going to shut that lineup out is not something that I would have imagined, but it was great. The satisfying part about winning that World Series was overcoming the two that we had lost. There were a lot of guys on that team that were a part of the 91 and 92 losses. So to kind of be able to navigate those disappointments with a lot of the same guys, and then ultimately be able to experience that championship with those guys as well, was a great, great feeling.
Yeah. And I think it speaks to you how important family is to you, that as you're winning the 1995 World Series, your thoughts go to your dad. And I think you're as happy for him as you are for you, because he got to see the Braves win a championship, right? Wasn't he a longtime Boston Braves fan? So here the Braves win a championship, and it's his son who brings it to him.
Yeah, he was a Boston Braves fan. He was a Red Sox fan. My dad was a huge baseball fan. And to be able to have him be able to experience something like that and watching his son do it, I can only imagine what he felt. I mean, I know how much pride I have watching my kids play. They've had the opportunity to win some high school championships and things like that. And I know how proud I was for them. So I can only imagine how my dad felt for me being able to do that, given that he was such a baseball fan. love the game so much. So yeah, it was a really, really neat experience to be able to do that.
Yeah, by the way, I'll get you out of here on this. That 1999 Nike commercial with Greg Maddux and Mark McGwire.
How long are they going to worship this guy? Hey, we got Cy Young winners over here.
Chicks dig the long ball.
Chicks dig the long ball.
Hey, have you guys seen Mark?
That's one of my all-time favorites. Was that fun to shoot with Greg?
It was. My agent came to me and he said, hey, would you be interested in doing a Nike commercial with Greg? And I was like, well, yeah, well, what is it? And I remember saying, I'm not really sure what it is, but I'll get the details. We'll get it to you and we'll figure it out. And I was like, okay. So they came to us and it was like, chicks dig the long ball. And we're like, okay, you know, it's whatever. It's Nike. We'll have some fun with it. But we did it on a road trip. And we did the first part of it. We were in Philadelphia. So a lot of the scenes that you see where it's the batting practice and it's the Greg and I running up and down the stairs at the stadium and all the Rocky stuff, that was in Philadelphia. A lot of the other stuff where we're doing the in the sauna and we're doing the working out and all that stuff we did in Florida. So I think both of us, as this thing is going along, we were like, what the hell are they doing with this? Like, where's this going? You know, like we had no idea. At one time they had us in Philadelphia, similar to the Rocky scene where he's in there beating up the slabs of meat. We did that. That scene didn't make it into the commercial, but you know, like I said, that's the kind of stuff that we're doing where we're both just like, where is this going? And yeah. I remember walking into the clubhouse one day and the commercial aired. And I remember being there and I was kind of stuck where I couldn't go anywhere. And I thought to myself, I hope this is good.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just going to get ridiculed because, you know, I'm here in the locker room with everybody. And when it got done, everybody was laughing and everybody loved it. So it was a good moment, but it's funny how many people still reference that commercial to me. And
you know, it's just classic.
It's great. You know, my wife and I do a ton of charity stuff, and you'd be surprised how well I get those Nike Chicks Dig the Long Ball t-shirts. She gets them made up and I'll send them out to Greg and we'll both sign them and put them on auctions, and they still fetch a ton of money. So it's pretty funny. It's had some lasting power.
Yeah, when Maddux, by the way, was being inducted to the Hall of Fame in 2014, I think you, he, and Smoltz were on MLB Tonight talking about that commercial. And which one of you was the best hitter?
Probably, Glad was probably the best hitter. Smoltz, he had the most power.
John, and, you're smiling. You agree?
Yeah, but I didn't get to take part in that commercial.
Do you remember what you said back to him?
I know, it was something sarcastic.
Yeah, you said,
Smoltz, chicks dig the long ball, not the bald spot.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right, yeah. I stole a page out of Greg's book on that one because he always, whenever he was getting into it with John, it always came back to his hair. So, it was fun. I mean, look, it was, like I said, it's had some lasting power, and I think it was just a really well-done commercial and funny. And I think what made it funny for people, particularly for people who know Greg and I, it was so out of our character. It was not who we were, how we carried ourselves, any of that stuff. We kind of put ourselves out there a little bit, which I think made it even better for people who knew us.
Well, listen, I so appreciate the time. Tom Glavine, 10-time All-Star, World Champion, World Series MVP, 2-time Cy Young Award winner, 4-time Silver Slugger, finishing your career with 305 wins and a first ballot Hall of Famer. Thank you so much for traveling back in time and talking about ballparks and your career.
My pleasure. Happy to do it.
All right. Have a great day, Tom. Thanks so much,
all right,
man.
All right. You too. Take care.
All right. Maybe it's just me, but I can't help but think about what would have happened had Tom Glavine decided to play hockey. Because I think by all accounts, he had a greater chance of becoming a hockey Hall of Famer than a baseball Hall of Famer. He was that talented at hockey. And had he decided to pursue that route and ended up with the LA Kings and playing alongside Wayne Gretzky, might that have meant that my Cleveland Indians would have won the 1995 World Series? It's one of those things that we'll never know, but does make you think about it, doesn't it? Lost Ballparks is produced by Mike Dunn, Xavier Guerra, Ryan Beard, Mandy Zavlakis, Kyle Schmidt, Brian Binger, John Carter, and Briggs Buckingham. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week, and tune in next week for another episode of the Lost Ballparks podcast.